and hearing about the traditions, it certainly excites me to go, okay, it would be really fascinating to like find legitimately in Colombia, for example, we found the house that salsa started in.
Really?
In Colombia.
Wow.
It's a small remote village on the coast. It was brought in by sailors from the Caribbean. It came down, they landed in Colombia, and they started bringing mixtapes to this little shack on the beach there. So we were able to find this community and then dance salsa on the same beach where it was founded. Like,
yeah,
that's wild.
That's crazy. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the 714 podcast. Today, I got my friend, my good friend, Mike Savas here. He's I really don't know the best way to explain what you do because you're just like an amazing guy overall.
Thank you.
But right now, he's traveling the world. What exactly is the challenge, right? It's the 12 skills in 12 months in 12 countries. Is that correct?
I'm thanks for having me today, brother. I've set off on this lifelong journey called Month in the Making.
Yeah.
And the way it's framed is a midlife awakening, not a crisis, but an awakening. So I'm going to 12 countries over 12 months, learning 12 unique skill sets.
Wow. That's incredible. Just like the first time I saw one of your videos on Instagram, I think it was on the Explore page or something. That's how I found out about you.
Oh yeah.
Wow. Yeah. And I saw one of your videos. I think this was a few months back, and you were doing, I think, scuba diving somewhere and
free diving in the Bahamas.
Yeah. Free diving. And I was like, okay, I thought that was just like one thing that you were doing. But then I looked at your page and you were doing a new skill, learning a new skill every month. So I was like, damn, this guy is amazing for trying to
thanks,
do that,
brother.
Yeah.
Yeah, look, it's certainly been a long, I've been out for about 10 months now. We've accomplished 7 of the missions. It's been long, it's been tough, but it's been an absolute blessing and completely humbled every day by what I don't know and how much there is to learn out there in the world. But, you know, I feel inspired, I'm excited, and we just keep going after it. And hopefully I'll continue to be able to, no serious injuries. I'm feeling strong.
Yeah,
and, you know, work's coming back, but that's okay. I'm going to keep pounding through and just adjusting the course as necessary.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the main point is the learning aspect of it. I think for you, like you wanted to learn these skills and yes, you meet the people and everything. And that's also a big part of it. But what really for you, I mean, you could explain this. What made you want to do this in the first place?
Sure. I mean, to just touch on what you mentioned there. Prior to the question, certainly the most attractive thing is learning the skills.
Mm-hmm.
Yet the more impactful component of this lifelong journey is actually the people that I've come in contact with. And it's more about community building and almost community understanding. So it's more about the identity associated with each of the skills. And within that component, the people that do this day in and day out. I'm just sort of an outsider stepping into these people's lives for a couple of weeks at a time. And that's the biggest takeaway is the lessons that these communities have taught me. And yes, the skills are what you see in the videos and what cool photos that come out of it. But that's almost secondary to the underlying emotional connections that have been formed. I mean, and not to answer your question, what made me want to do this? Truly, it was just inspiration throughout life and the idea of, you know, what would it be like to live these alternative lifestyles? And I think a lot of us fantasize in a very beautiful way about what a different life might look like. And, you know, the grass is always greener and wow, what if I lived in Japan or what if I lived in you know, Kenya? What if I lived in South America?
Mm-hmm.
What would I even do down there? So much like everyone else, I always just thought about what that could feel like and what emotional sort of excitement that would bring. And I've structured my life in a way where I could still run my business and tap into these things.
Yeah.
And when COVID hit, I said, look, now's the time. So truth be told, I've been planning it for about 12 to 15 years. Didn't think it was going to happen quite this early. I was going to give it a few more years until my company winded down. But you know, the universe said, okay, this is your chance. You could either go for it or not. So I went for it.
Really? I mean, that usually during COVID times, people weren't traveling, but you decided, all right, let's just give it a go right now. You know?
Exactly. I'm not one to sit still too much. And I think, you know, if you have the means and the look, I don't have a wife, I don't have kids, so, and I've been saving up for quite some time. So for me, there was no significant obstacle other than COVID to keep me from going. And I knew with my long travel history, I've been on the road for about 15 years now, pretty much full time. I knew that I had a really strong network of people internationally that could help me if I needed help. Mm-hmm. I couldn't think of a good reason not to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I'm glad that you're documenting it as well. I know you post videos about it every day.
And Diego's right here, actually. Diego's my videographer and editor. He's done 5 of the 7 months with me. So he's here working his little butt off and also having the time of his life. He loves editing. Yeah. I don't. So, we're both doing our thing.
Yeah. All your passions, right? And I mean, that's great because I think a lot of people will be inspired by wherever you travel. And not only do you just travel and visit the touristy places, you know, you go and deep into the country and meet the locals and try to go further than just wherever like a tourist attraction is. And it gets to show a lot more of the country and the people in that fact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, look, what's unique about this is I'm not here to tell a tourist or traveler story. I'm mm-hmm. here to very much learn a skill and get deeply embedded in one community. So wherever that skill takes me based off what the locals are saying, that's where we go. You know, if I stay in one house for a month and learn whatever the thing is, that's totally fine. Certainly within the month, there's lots of opportunities to take these skills on the road. And whether that's, you know, dancing on stage in Colombia at a local salsa club or taking capoeira to the streets in Salvador and Brazil, where capoeira started. A big part of it is learning the history of these skills. And I don't know what that's going to mean by the end of the month. Yet, as I'm with these people learning their stories and hearing about the traditions, it certainly excites me to go, okay, it would be really fascinating to like find legitimately in Colombia, for example, we found the house that salsa started in.
Really?
In Colombia.
Wow.
It's a small remote village on the coast. It was brought in by sailors from the Caribbean. It came down, they landed in Colombia and they started bringing mixtapes to this little shack on the beach there. So we were able to find this community and then dance salsa on the same beach where it was founded. Like,
yeah,
that's wild.
That's crazy.
We're not hitting all of the tourist destinations for sure. We're trying to, I shouldn't even say we're trying to go deeper. We're just trying to understand the skill and the people behind it. And wherever that takes us, that's where we go.
Yeah. Yeah. And you said you also were taught capoeira. Where did that inspiration come from for you to learn that? Because that's like a type of martial arts, right? I'm not like completely familiar with it, but it's very cultural and also deep within. I'm pretty sure it's like Brazilian. I'm not sure if that's correct.
Yeah, look, capoeira is an Afro-Brazilian martial art that was brought over during the slave trade. Mm-hmm. It was a sort of amalgamation of 4 different regions in Africa, from what I understand. These slaves were brought to Brazil, they weren't allowed to practice their traditions anymore. So they kind of came together in a way that they were permitted to by the slave owners. So they couldn't fight. So they created a form of martial art that, as foreigners, we call it dance fighting. Mm-hmm. It's 2 people in a circle together. They call it a joda. And this dance is actually a very lethal martial art. In the 1800s, there were gangs in Brazil that took capoeira. And when the conquistadors, the explorers, were trying to capture them, they would say it would take 3 or 4 men in full armor and horseback to capture one capoeirista because they're so quick and they're so nimble. And yes, it's very beautiful. It's very elegant, mm-hmm. but it's also can be very combative and very serious, dangerous. So it's not only the dance or the fight. There's also deep, deep music component to this. Lots of songs and sing-alongs. There's a layer of serious respect to your elders and the masters. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine that these slaves of the 16, 17, 1800s dancing around a campfire when their master wasn't watching, dancing with one another, but also playing with one another. It's very much a trickster sport where you're trying to convince the other person that you're not going to hit them, or you are going to hit them. And then if they guess wrong, then you actually hit them.
Yeah.
So it's pretty magical.
Damn. I mean, yeah, I didn't know it was that much of a history behind it, like from the 16th century and the slaves created it. And I mean, I love history. I don't know about you, like you probably like history, but to me, learning about the past of how these traditions have started, and you mentioned the salsa house where it first started, mm-hmm. you know, you get to learn how people thought about these certain, or how they lived in that era and what they were focused on. And some of these art forms are still here to this day, which I'm grateful for, because, you know, if the capoeira tradition wasn't passed along over generations and generations, we might not have it today, you know?
Mm-hmm, and exactly.
It's great that you have these masters and people that are knowledgeable about it that can share it to others. And now through the internet, it's documented and it can mm-hmm. live on through that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And speaking of these skills that you've learned, what has been the most challenging skill in your opinion that you've done out of the months you've traveled?
I would say surfing. I think surfing is a skill that takes many people years to really understand. I was fortunate to do it intensively for 3.5 weeks mm-hmm. prior to an injury coming in and a storm surge.
Really?
But you know, that takes a long time to, and I had a fantastic teacher. So for those that are kind of doing it on their own, it's not something that you can pick up in 2 or 3 days. You need weeks or months to really get even amateur at it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think dancing to a degree, you can, you know, you're not falling on your face and getting pounded, right? Capoeira, I'm by no means very adept at it yet. You know, again, you can swing your leg around over and over again and slowly pick it up. Surfing, you really got to get hammered a bunch of times.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the repetition. Repetition is the mother of skill. So the more times you repeat something, then it becomes part of you. And mm-hmm. I personally haven't surfed too much. Like I live in Orange County near the beach. People surf mm-hmm. all the time over here, but for me, I wasn't really interested in it particularly. Like it's probably a really fun sport, and I do bodyboarding, which is where you lay on the board and just ride the waves. But surfing, that's a real skill where mm-hmm. you have to just be in the water every day, literally just go in every single day. Mm-hmm. And I mean, some of these people, you've probably seen like videos on the internet of these 100-foot waves and shit. Like that's insane to me that people can ride that. Like they see 100-foot wave, I would just run. Like I wouldn't even get near the ocean. Like there's a tsunami coming and then I would just be out of there. But these guys see it as an opportunity, and they're skilled at that. And of course there's danger with it, with that level of risk, but mm-hmm. they're really just passionate about what they do. And it shows like when they take that much of a risk.
Yeah. Look, that's the beauty of seeing people who are masters at their trade and the amount of effort they have to put into it to grow to that skill level. Yeah. So these people, anyone who's at that level is committing their entire life to that trade.
Yeah.
So it's really just such a blessing to be able to witness that and just be a bystander and learn from people at that level. Mm-hmm. Not to say my masters can ride a 200-foot wave, but you know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah, so there's people like that, man, that they're just so obsessed with their craft that it could be anything, you know, that some chefs are like that. Gordon Ramsay, any career, any aspect of life, really, there's people that put every amount of focus into it, and you see the results. Like they're mm-hmm. in it for themselves. They're not in it to have possessions of this or that. And even I watched a documentary recently on Anthony Bourdain, and he was a chef before he wrote the book that got him famous and everything, but he was obsessed with his craft as a chef, and that translated into whatever documenting he did. And he traveled a lot as well. He traveled and talked or traveled and shared many experiences with a lot of people. And he went like pretty much, he kind of lost his mind in that process, 'cause he was so obsessed with his craft that he just didn't have it. And unfortunately he passed away a few years ago. But there are people like that, that are really obsessed with their craft.
Yeah. And those are the best at what they do, you know?
And I wanted to, speaking of like food and culinary stuff, I know you were in Italy. How was that experience?
Yeah, just spent the last month in the primarily Tuscany in the northern region of Italy, where the intention was to go out and become a chef, yet it kind of turned more into becoming a culinary artisan, is the way that me and Diego branded it, because every day we were spending time with different farmers who specialized in their specific thing. So a baker that meditates over his bread in the morning, two women that save endangered species of animals from the Etruscan age. The Etruscan means pre-Roman. So she's to this date saved five different species of animals: horse, goat, wild boar, and I forget the other two. But they also use them for meat. But they're doing it in a way where it's a closed system. It's conservation based, and they're the only ones who have the sort of, I guess the easiest way to explain it would be like a patent. You have to follow very strict rules to work with these animals and ensure that they are bred in the correct manner. Because if the bloodlines overlap with other species, it's no longer like the true Etruscan type of DNA species. So anyway, these individuals specializing in local cuisine and local types of food, cheese farmers, winemakers. So every day I was kind of with someone different. And then at night we'd go into the kitchen and learn how to do gourmet meal prep with a local chef there who does everything farm to table, meaning he has his own garden, his own plants, animals, and then whatever he has in his garden that day, he makes for guests that evening. So it was a really unique perspective on agriculture, farming techniques, my relationship with food, where it comes from. I had to, for the first time ever, I slaughtered an animal. It was a small guinea fowl. So taking an animal's life and seeing what it took to actually do that and how it change my perception on meat and how much of it we're eating and things like this.
Because over here in America especially, we really take for granted all that's provided for us at when we go into a supermarket or any store in that matter. You see all the groceries and the meats lined up, but we really don't know where it comes from. And I'm glad that you got to experience this place where you get to see where all the food comes from, this farmers that grow it, and they're really into a certain type of grain or anything really. They get to show you the process of it. When I think that's really important, because you really don't know until you experience that, like slaughtering an animal. I've personally never done it, and I know it would definitely change your perspective on meat, because you see the amount of meat that people eat. It's like there's in and out, there's lines every single day. And just, you know, it's probably mind boggling to see the factories that produce it, but understanding where it comes from and how we can make a difference so that we could have more of the local farmers. You know, I think that's important, because right now we don't really know where our food comes from. It could come from a different state or anywhere around the world, so we really don't know, and that perspective is important to take, and I really feel important about that.
Look, I agree. I think it's two points that you touched on. One is where our food comes from, which is hugely important just to ensure it's fresh and nutritious.
And
you know, it's not rocket science to realize what's happening in America, and the cause for many of our illnesses stem from our food systems. Mm-hmm. And food systems is something that's broken and needs to be greatly enhanced.
You could probably taste and feel the difference of the food. Like if you had something that
restaurant. I had a skin condition for the last 20 years. I have white spots called tinea versicolor. For the mm-hmm. first time ever, I don't have it.
Wow.
And that's in part because of some new medication I tried and combined with the diet. And that's never occurred to me. And so just 1 month of not eating food filled with pesticides.
Yeah,
done in the right way, meaning you're not destroying the soil. There's something to be said about soil life and how animals impact soil life. And mm-hmm. over harvesting really can change your body's gut biome and what it's made up of. So that's one part of it, is the food systems and where our food comes from. And the second is our relationship to food, mm-hmm. which is what you said. And yes, we eat way too much meat. That's no question to that. We don't know where the meat comes from. And having some empathy towards animal life, and not saying don't eat meat at all, just having a balanced diet and incorporating good, nutritious fruits and vegetables and grains back into the course is entirely necessary for humanity to exist in a happy way. Mm-hmm. Your gut biome is directly related to your mental state. And so we don't destroy the planet. And, you know, it's not even like this great grand philosophical conversation anymore. It's just factual.
Yeah. And it just feels better. Like personally, I'm Indian and I eat a lot of Indian food because my mom cooks a lot of homemade Indian food. And mm-hmm. it's literally the healthiest part of my diet is eating at dinner. Like we have different vegetables that my mom makes, and it's compared to what I could get at a restaurant over here, or go out to eat, or something at the supermarket, like whatever type of food that my mom makes, I could feel the difference in my body just because of the type of food it is. And I think people just need to become knowledgeable about the difference, because it's probably easy to go pick up fast food, or it's convenient, and that's why it's probably become more popular to take that route. But when you start to understand what's better for you at the end of the day, and mm-hmm. what's going to make you more happy and just feel better throughout the day, it's these local produce and local meats and stuff that can actually benefit your health at the end of the day. Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Yeah. And have you in Italy, you probably had pizza as well. Like that's one of my favorite places to eat pizza is Italy. And I don't know if you went to Naples. Naples. I went there a few years ago, and that was probably still to this day my favorite pizza I've ever had is in Naples. I eat pizza every day. Okay.
That's where it's known for. That's where it's known for, right? Yeah. So you pick the right spot, brother. No question.
Yeah. Yeah. It's literally the best pizza I've ever had, because there are people that are skilled in that process that have been doing it for generations down the line. And whatever that skill is, you can't really replicate it anywhere else, I'm pretty sure, because of the water and the soil, like you said, is different mm-hmm. around that region. So and the cheese as well, and mm-hmm. aspects.
Again, it comes down to farming techniques and local access to ingredients. That they're doing things differently there. They're local farmers, and things are locally sourced and are not preserved. So I think I'm going to disagree with you. I think the techniques can be duplicated to some degree. Mm-hmm. It's making pizza. So yeah, some would be like, is it open stove fire? Is it an industrial oven? Things like this, but then local ingredients, and then beyond local ingredients, it's the climate zones that the ingredients are being grown in.
Yeah.
So, and I spoke to some of the chefs about this. They're like, again, to your point, you can't do it elsewhere, not because the techniques aren't the same, but the base, water, air, wind, soil, all of those components cannot be replicated elsewhere. So that's why Italy and Croatia and Spain have the best olive oil, and other items that, that are known for in these regions. It's because of these aspects.
Yeah, the basic core components of of being able to make it. Yeah, and right now you said you're currently in Croatia. What skill are you learning?
I'm becoming a sailing instructor this month. Truth is, I already know how to sail to a degree, but I wanted to take it very seriously because I wanted to be at a much higher level. So I decided to dedicate a month to becoming a sailor, and more specifically a sailing instructor. So basically starting from what would be considered zero. So very basics of sailing, just refreshing myself, going all the way up to chartering a 52 catamaran. And then beyond that, I'll get my sailing instructor license. And then I'll do a solo performance course with my friend who's a professional sponsored transatlantic racer. And he's going to take a few days out and show me how to do solo racing.
Yeah. Damn, that's crazy. Like, I've personally never, is it a sail boat with the?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it sounds like
we're on a 48-foot monohull. You know, there'd be five of us on boards, all pulling lines and hoisting the sails. And then, yeah, in 2 weeks' time, I'll have a catamaran and then a small little solo vessel that'll just be me doing everything.
Really? Wow. Yeah, they have races too on some sailboats, right? They do some type of race I've seen, like where.
Oh yeah, I mean absolutely. Look, it's in the Olympics. There's professional sports around it. They're all different types of vessels and in different areas around the world. Sailing is a very sort of ancient and highly respected sport. So.
Yeah, and that's a really good skill to learn, I think, because. We're not 75% of the earth is water. So if you know how to maneuver around that, you're pretty good.
I'm ready to go when zombies attack, buddy. Don't worry about that. I got all my plan B's in place.
Yeah. That's great though. Like being able to sail and you're trying to learn it, to do it by yourself. Right. So you're going to be the only one on the sailboat.
That's the plan.
Yeah. Yeah. That's crazy. Just being able to cruise around by yourself and it's in the Mediterranean, right? Or
that's
are
right,
you?
Yep.
Okay, Mediterranean. Yeah.
Yeah, Croatia, Italy, and France.
Yeah. Is the water good right now or does it change at all?
Well, it's warmer than ever because of what's going on in the world. But with that said, it's very pleasant. It's just hotter than normal. I'd say it's about, I don't know, 73 degrees.
Okay. Have the locals said anything about that? Like, have they been impacted in a way because of the temperature, or are they fine with it?
I mean, look, there's heat waves here. There were local fires on the islands just yesterday, but I haven't spoken to the locals about the local fishing scene because of it.
Okay, yeah, it's crazy though what's been happening with climate change in general, like around the world. I know in Northern California, especially, there's been fires for a few months now and it's still going on. So, I mean, the world's changing. And I recently talked to a marine biologist as well. And he said, if we don't protect our oceans in a greater fact, we're going to have to, there's no possible return to a normal way of life because the temperature is going to continue to increase. And there's these, I forget exactly what he called it. It was blue carbon, I think. And that's
blue
carbon. It's something that has to do with, the seagrass that's in the water. And that basically the seagrass basically collects the carbon, from the atmosphere and puts it into the ocean. And so that's what he said. That's what can help us reduce the carbon in the atmosphere, and make a greater impact. But because people are overfishing and there's so many, you know, businesses involved in the ocean, the seagrass population isn't as flourishing as it once was. And so if there are some regulations put in place in the ocean, that could also help people as well. And really everything has to just be in balance. Right now it's like humans are up here and then everything else is going down. You know, everything just has to be in balance.
You're right, man. Then that's the reoccurring theme everywhere I go. Things are messed up and we got to do something about it.
Yeah. It's crazy. I mean, it shows like what humans have the capability of doing. And then we always try to engineer ourselves out of it at the end of the day. Like anything that goes wrong, we think that we could fix it when really sometimes we really just have to let it grow naturally, right? Like Chernobyl, what happened with the radioactive site, after I think 20 years or something, the animals and plants are growing back and taking
just
over.
Just let nature do its thing. It can handle itself. We just gotta stop interfering a lot of this stuff.
Literally, that's it. That's all it is. And that's like the best part of going to these places like national parks here in the US. I love going to them just because of the natural beauty. It's just left alone and really that you get to see it for what it is. And that's, I mean, for me, traveling somewhere, I've been to a few countries, but probably not as many as you, but still have traveled a little bit. And the best part is seeing all the nature that's around it and seeing how people live. Like in Costa Rica, one of the greenest places I've ever seen. It probably is in the world, but just seeing the rainforest and all these plants and animals, it makes you feel better just seeing all that green around you. I don't know if it's a scientific thing, but you just feel better when you see all that green, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And for you, what made you travel, or what made you get the travel bug in the first place? Like
I started off on a program called Semester at Sea, which is a floating college university that sails around the world. Mm-hmm. So it lasts about 110 days, 600 college students at a time. And you get access to incredible political figures, incredible academic opportunities while you're on board. And then when you're in country, you get your passport back and you're allowed to travel independently, you know, as an 18, 19, 20 year old. And it just opens you up to a world of opportunities. So if anyone's listening to this, that's in college or has a younger sibling, I would highly encourage them to look at Semester at Sea as an opportunity to change your trajectory in life. And open your eyes in ways that even a normal study abroad experience can't do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because traveling, it changes everything about you, because for so long you might be living in a certain area and that's all you know is the people around there, the food around there, and you go somewhere else that it might be completely different customs and ideas. And I think to be open-minded about that, you know, you don't have to change completely to whatever they're doing, but just to learn different aspects of whatever they're doing, learn the cooking or just meeting the people, really, it'll help you understand more about humans.
One of the ways that we can change the way we do business is by getting other people's perspectives, and traveling is the easiest way to do that. And I think that's been proven time after time. Not many people, have the opportunity to travel. I think technology bridges that gap and can still open people's eyes in ways that previously they weren't exposed to those things. Yeah. So I'm hopeful that technology helps people reconnect with traditional ways of living and traditional ways of connecting. Mm-hmm. And I think that might be a way out, is using technology to reform gaps and bridges into the way that we used to work with each other and work with nature.
Yeah, I agree with that a lot. And speaking of technology and advancement, this is kind of separate from that. You've probably seen the news of people and billionaires going into space. Would you ever try that? If somebody handed you a ticket, would you ever go to space?
Someone handed me a ticket, I would. Why not? Not any aspiration I have. Sounds like an epic adventure.
I know. Yeah, because I mean, if, I think very relatively few people, less than 1,000, I'm pretty sure, have been to space. And I think that's going to be the biggest, like, mind fuck in the world is seeing Earth from space. Like, you'll understand how small we are in comparison to everything going around.
Yeah, that'll shift the perspective real quick, right?
Yeah, yeah, just seeing everything. And, like, it could also help travel, too, if it gets really cheap to go to space, they figure something out, some technology. Because if you go up to space and you get on Earth's orbit, you could travel at 18,000 miles per hour and basically go around the world in 90 minutes or less, and anywhere around the world. So if that happens, then, you know,
wow,
I hope
wow,
that,
wow, wow. That's wild.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy.
That is wild.
Yeah. Humans are incredible, but we have our issues, but they're fucking incredible at building shit. Like I even saw, I think yesterday, Elon Musk was talking about AI and robots and shit. And he built this AI humanoid, basically like a human robot that can do simple tasks. Like if they're moving boxes or something, it walks, it can, wow, it shows screens, and it's AI. So it learns while it's doing the task, really. So, you know, the advancement is taking place and we're living in the future, basically. Like all this stuff is happening, so much advancement, and it's probably the best time to be alive, really.
What an exciting time to be alive. I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. It's insane. Yeah. And I think, That should wrap it up. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks, man. Pleasure to be here. Let me know if I can ever do anything for you, and if anyone has any interest in reaching out, by all means, I'm here. I'm easy to talk to. No problem.
If you want to shout out like whatever social media or where they can check you out.
It's just my name. So we're telling the story on YouTube and Instagram. Same thing at Savas on the go. So my last name is Savas, S-A-V-A-S on the go. Very simple.
Yeah. Yeah, really simple. Please go check it out because he has some amazing stuff on there.
Thanks, Sean.
And it's really great. And thank you again for coming on. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and hope you guys enjoyed it as well. Thank you, man.
Thanks, buddy.
Yeah.
Bye. Cheers.